Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jeff Dunphy, and it is Friday, May 13th, and this is Retooling for Our Coming of Age. Interestingly, last week when we did the show, it cut us off at the 22-minute mark, and so what I'm going to do is continue on with part two of episode 11 of The Art and Science of Self-Discovery. My apologies for that technical glitch, however, I trust that this proves to be the continuation of episode 11, and it's as insightful as I would like it to be. Now, we left off chatting about analytic mind and contemplative mind. And the analytic mind, as you will remember in the first part of this, the analytic mind is what creates separativeness. It's important to us, but it creates separativeness, and it also is very keen on separateness, but also conquering things. And one of the things that I want to readdress is there is a place where our contemplative mind can step in, bring us into presence or bring us into essence mind. And it's a very vital and valid part of who we are. And it also has a tendency to redefine who we think we are when you can plug into it. Okay. So now let's chat a little. We did sort of define numinuses before, and I think, in fact, I was possibly a little cut off, and we were talking about where numinous comes from, and it comes from the Latin name numen, which means sort of divine power, and I sort of mentioned that you don't have to be strictly religious to understand numinous. You can be, and I think I was talking about France and how you're in the middle of France and you're wandering down or driving down this wonderful road, and it looks like you're in a tunnel made of trees and flowers and blossoms, and it's just quite exquisite. Or you can be in a museum and see a piece of music that is, or a piece of art that is absolutely extraordinary, or you can see a song that is absolutely exquisite, and that's they communicate a spiritual or a profoundly divine vibe, not necessarily religious vibe, but a divine vibe, okay? So, you know, for example, if you were to read A Treatise on the Moon, the analytic mind, the NASA scientist, would likely give you all the statistics and the measurements and where the craters are and the longitude and the latitude of various things, okay? But contemplative mind, it actually prefers to go to where the poet philosophers do, okay? And they speak in terms of its magic and its mystery and its influence, and it talks about the moon as a mover of men, as the mistress, if you will. Okay, and so the scientific account may be interesting, but it can nowhere near inspire the numinous state within you, nor touch your soul, to traverse the abyss. You know, we're also the scientist and the poet evaluate and see things through different eyes, and they tell different kinds of truth. Okay, the scientist describes, and the poet hints at the relational possibilities that can expand one's consciousness and invite connection. Now, because physical matter is the basis for being in a physical reality, it deserves attention, and the analytic mind attends to it, and it uses the scientific method. But it needs to go hand in hand with the contemplative mind, right? But because the human being, our humanity, our vignette, is really more than the sum of its parts, something more is needed for more full comprehension. So let's chat a little. Let's consider the double-stranded helix that supports your DNA. Okay, so the basis for the living physical body. Now, analytic mind concerns itself with its mere physical basis for being. Contemplative mind inquires even further. So studying this double-strand configuration, contemplative mind asks what such might mean at the level of cosmic expression. And we use in the Lamasery and in Retooling, we use this concept of the law of correspondence, as above, so below, and as below, so above. And what is it about the double-stranded helix that we can see on the microscopic level and also on the macroscopic level? So rather than looking only at the genetic basis for a human being, Contemplative mind inquires into the basis of beingness and postulates that the DNA strand is only a microscopic representation of something much vaster, the law of correspondence. Contemplative mind can entertain the direct parallel between being and beingness, whereas analytic mind generally chooses not to even go there, okay? Chooses not to even go there. So cracking the code for the human genome position, and that has become one of the great points of interest for the 21st century. And if we listen to Ray Kurzweil talk about it, when they just started, they were using linear thinking. Ray Kurzweil said that, you know, they got 10% of it cracked. And when that was told to Ray, he said, okay, well, they're almost done. And everybody said, well, no, they took years and years and years to get 10%. It means they're going to be done in 100 years. And he goes, no. You don't understand the law of acceleration, and you don't understand exponential growth. There's a wonderful place in here that once you start the ball rolling, the law of acceleration takes it and spins it forward. Okay, so analytic mind, in terms of this genome project, delights in all the raw data and as well, right? And contemplative mind, however, actually sees the symbolic relevance of the DNA in the genome project, holding that it must be predicated on something of a greater model, and that's indulging in the law of correspondence. That higher frequency must therefore support beingness on all levels, not only just for the human and the animal species, but for other phenomena that can be observed and or explored in this cosmic experience. Again, as above, so below. So, therefore, a correspondence can be made to the two fundamental parameters for beingness, time and space. Now, these can be considered the spiritual genetic material for beingness in the cosmos, which correlates to that double-stranded helix that supports the physical DNA spiral. Contemplative mind would argue that one of the DNA strands draws from the continuum known as space, the other from the continuum known as time. So looking carefully at these two continuums, or continua, I suspect, contemplative mind can actually observe the basis for beingness. The strand, or continuum of space, continues and corresponds to matter, for matter takes up space. The strand, or the continuum of time, corresponds to consciousness. It takes both matter and consciousness to support being in the physical cosmos. Although all of the permutations on each cannot possibly be demonstrated by the example of a single planet or even a single solar system, one can at least look at the physical realm and make certain leaps into the parapsychical realm. In so doing, one combines the strong faculties of both analytic mind and contemplative mind. This is where science is going. It's going to start to recognize that the physical realm of reality is but one aspect of it. There is a physical, there is an etheric, there is an astral, there is a lower mental, there is a higher mental, and it is in our pursuit of marrying the lower realms, the physical, the astral, and the lower mental, or the intellect, analytic, with the higher realms, which is Atma, Buddhi, and Manas. Manasic is that's the higher mind, contemplative mind. Okay, so the three rungs of this space continuum, there's a succession of rungs. The first corresponds to the mineral kingdom, the function of which is to generate a basis for stability of structure. Although you've learned from analytic mind that all matter may exist in one of three states, solid, liquid, or gas, these three states aren't readily available in observable, if you will, in the mineral kingdom, okay? Indeed, you probably need to heat those puppies up in order to change their physical state, okay? We primarily observe the mineral kingdom in the solid state, although you recognize that it may exist in a liquid state at the Earth's core. And the gaseous state, however, is something you must consider or postulate. Pretty unobservable in the mineral state. Okay? So it's conceivable to most people that minerals could convert to a gaseous state somewhere in the universe where temperatures are sufficient to change them in that regard, right? Although there is a stability within the minerals, such may not be able to refer to as consciousness, for it lacks the ability to interact with others of its own kind, and there is consciousness of everything, as one of the postulates of the Hermetic philosophy suggests, but we kind of don't resonate with that. Okay, so the second rung supports the plant kingdom, where a level of awareness can be observed that is not demonstrable in the mineral kingdom. Now, plants do respond to their environment, and they do have the ability to mutate as a species, and one cannot see that process is conscious. But in plants, the awareness is strictly tied to the morphology, the form and function of the plant, and that is true even in terms of responsiveness to humans. Now, these plants that have had interaction with us for generations, houseplants and domesticated garden plants, do in fact respond more readily to the bioenergetic field of us than do plants that haven't been domesticated. As they interact with the human kingdom, they become more responsive to it, and they demonstrate awareness. Now, when we play with Masaru Emoto, he talks about how water can be influenced, and when he nourishes plants with water that is imbued with love and kindness and grace and gratitude, those plants flourish. If he nourishes plants with water that has been imbued with hatred and ugly and nasty and harshness, the plants perish. They effectively wither, and away they go. I've also got a lovely conversation about the aromatherapy business, which is not so much the aromatherapy business, but how plants interact with the animal kingdom, and it's this. In Africa, there are certain trees that the giraffes feed off of. And in these trees, where the tree is full of blossoms and full of leaves, the giraffe starts to eat the tree, and the tree goes, "Let me serve you, animal kingdom," and here we go. And the giraffe comes along and starts to eat the tree. Now, the tree is conscious enough that once the giraffe has eaten enough of the leaves as to threaten its continued existence, the tree says, "Okay, you've fed enough, you've eaten the tree enough. You need to stop." So the tree's consciousness says, "I'm going to now start to release tannic acid into the leaves." And the tannic acid, for those of you who know, creates a bitterness to the leaf. So the giraffes have been feeding on these, and all of a sudden the plant in its consciousness releases tannic acid, and it tells all other plants in the neighborhood, "Release tannic acid so the giraffes don't come over and destroy you." And sure enough, the giraffes come to the tree the next morning and go, "Whoa, this doesn't taste as good as it did a day or a week ago." And the tree in and of itself, with its consciousness, participates in an act that says, "I give to you until I shouldn't be giving anymore, because that will compromise my existence." So there's a collaboration going on, which is stunningly brilliant. And it talks about how wise and how clever Mother Nature is, okay? And that's a very interesting dance between the plant kingdom and the animal kingdom. Now, the third rung on our space continuum supports the animal kingdom. Now, this is a little different, and it's a complexity, right? The responsiveness to the environment is exquisitely heightened, as well as the responsiveness to minerals and plants, and as we talked about, right? So the ability to communicate is obvious, as is the emotional complexity. We're now seeing on Facebook these various places where I've recently been, that this man opens a cage and there's a female lion in the cage, and the female lion just leaps into his arms and nuzzles with him and cuddles with him and loves him up. And there is a bond between these two that is quite dramatic. There's another one where there's a black panther who runs around a cage, and there's a young woman in the top of the cage, and he runs around and literally, again, leaps into her arms. And it's a magic place where the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom start to participate. The movie, the theaters that came out recently with The Jungle Book, which was written by a very esoteric author named Rudyard Kipling, it again talks about how the animal kingdom and the human kingdom interact, okay? Now, animals may not be as self-aware in the way humans are, so having sort of that inner expression of a conscience, but the ability to create complex personal agendas and strategize responses is yet to be present. However, those of you who have animals, you know that they communicate in all kinds of ways, okay? Now, you can see at this level of the third rung, while matter can contain and utilize consciousness, Consciousness is predominantly driven by the requirements of matter, food, shelter, comfort, and relationship within their own family grouping. Now, although these basic needs are readily observable in the animals of the wild, animals keeping human company reach out for social relationships with humans and with other animals not in their own family. This is where we see the dogs and the owls, or the cats and the owls, and all these animals interacting with one another, which is quite magic. Indeed, it's as if the definition of family broadens to include many species outside their own genetic line. Now, animals aren't necessarily drawn into the spiritual realm, but that is where we then start to express our humanity, because humanity is a link between the lowest of the most material and the most spiritual. And it is said by Douglas Baker and also by many of the ancient writers that the kingdom of mankind is the most dense and the most spiritual of any kingdoms known in our realm. There are far more dense realms of matter, but they aren't anywhere near as spiritual. And there are far more spiritual realms of being, but they are not anywhere near as dense as we are. And that is where we talk to the premise that we, that the realm of awakened humanity, at this time of revelation, we awaken because we need to be the hands and feet of the hierarchy. Okay, so now we talk about the three corresponding rungs on the time consciousness continuum. Okay, so as a matter of balance, one must postulate three corresponding rungs, or levels of awareness, on this time consciousness continuum. The first, or human rung level, is the first state in which consciousness defines matter, as was noted with the rungs of the space-matter continuum. Just the opposite is true. Matter defines the consciousness it contains. Clearly, the shift to the time consciousness continuum demonstrates a huge shift in the reality that can be expressed. Although it's true that there are individuals in the human category who seem to demonstrate that their matter defines their consciousness, such is not actually true. Of course, on the first level or rung for the continuum of consciousness, there will be examples of those reflecting both the rungs on the space-matter continuum as well as higher rungs of the time consciousness continuum. Clearly, on this continuum, consciousness becomes increasingly complex, with all kinds of variances expressed by ways of the infinite potential relationship of matter and consciousness. We must pay attention, however, that the first rung, or human level, is a developmental level in which consciousness is still in training. So this is the level in which spiritual education takes place and provides the means whereby one may break out of the box of limitation. We become aware of the vessel that we're in, and we need to extricate ourselves from its overwhelming influence. Indeed, this is the direction to which spiritual education points in absolutely every ancient tradition. Even if one tradition sees the goal of that education differently from another. So one of the notable characteristics of human consciousness that differs from consciousness in the animal kingdom is the presence of self-doubt, particularly of the human psyche, but which is absent as succeeding higher rungs on the consciousness continuum are negotiated. Although it may be difficult for some ego minds to bear, it's both useful and instructive to consider the human state to be the beginning step for the embodiment of consciousness. The next higher rungs support the consciousness level of what have been called the gods, or ETs, or extraterrestrials. And due to a whole bunch of popularized science fictions, there are those who really do confuse ETs with what are called aliens. And although both exist, these two terms are emphatically not interchangeable. Although a lengthy description of aliens is certainly possible, suffice it here to say that they are holographic projections from some of the murkier collective experience of our pasts. For example, assume for a moment that multiple generations have nurtured negative premonitions surrounding the meaning of the appearance of a comet in the sky, generating terror at seeing a comet. Because the creative power of the mind is so astounding, a kind of archetype arises. imbued by what seems to be its own life from the projections of so many terrified people. So this archetypical entity is said to be holographic because people of any time can step into it, thereby allowing their entire experience to be modified and perhaps even dominated by it. As this terrifying projection regarding the comet and its perceived negative potential are vibrated out along this thin filament of light, remember our discussion of the diamond net, the intranet, the archetype is held, you might say, within the net, available for conscious beings at many levels to experience. Now, let's plug back into analytic and contemplative mind, okay? So in earlier times, people were very fearful of volcanoes and earthquakes, imbuing both with mystical powers over mere human beings. Now, fortunately, few hold such beliefs today, but many have replaced such with beliefs in menacing evil beings from outer space, imbuing them with like-minded power. It's the collective belief in such things that create these entities, but they are called alien because they stand outside of the creational scheme for our Earth. Simply stated, they are holographic projections of massive, negative, and fearful thought. The power of group projection is unbelievably strong, and a viable creative force which needs to be reckoned with. Thus, there are these collective projections, and they take on the characteristics of a living entity as projected, and can be accessed by anyone who harbors a fear of such, or for whatever reason has the karma to experience them. Some, particularly those of the archetype of the evil entity from outer space, have even been imbued with awareness. Such awareness does not come from the source of all being, but rather from collective creative projection. This is in the astral realm. Clearly, they are alien to the consciousness continuum. Now, if we take a look at the simple mathematics of this, let's pay attention to the statistical realization that the odds that there are not conscious individuals living somewhere else in the universe, in the cosmos, is pretty flippin' skinny. Okay? Now also, let's continue for a moment, because now the CIA is starting to come out, and we've got some very interesting people doing some very interesting work on extraterrestrials or ETs. There's a guy on the network or on the internet called Stephen Greer, who's done some pretty big things. Serious Disclosure is out there that may require some viewing and some investigation, but this is something that you need to go and investigate yourself. As we always say in the Lamasery, don't believe anything we have to say so much as go and do your own investigation so that you can know whether this is true or not. Okay? Now, ETs, as Stephen Greer points out, but as we probably can get, there are those beings who have evolved beyond the level of human consciousness, but they may choose physical embodiment as a means to help humanity in their finding of the next step on the consciousness continuum. Now, it's important that we don't plug too much into the analytic mind here and create any more dogma, but standing between the human level and the level of the cosmic beings, these ETs move freely in and out of physical form. On planet Earth, the form taken is generally of that of a sort of a recognized human form, or Adam Kadmon model, which is the beginning man, okay? There are two reasons for this. The first is that the earthly human form is easy to manifest among humans, since the human consciousness all around holds the creative parameters for manifestation. Secondly, until humans evolve to a state where they can accept other physical forms as potentially higher consciousness forms, it's difficult to create the necessary relationships with humans to facilitate their growth. So in other words, it's important for humans that they not designate ETs as alien, since such would only reinforce the holographic image and the astral projection that these aliens exist within the scope of creation and are seeking to compromise humanity. There is a meme out there going on, which Hollywood propagates, and that is ETs are coming to hurt you, where in fact, if you think it through logically, if they are so advanced that they can get here from other realms, they are more evolved than we are, and consequently they get the aspect of the three C's, and the three C's are collectivism, collaboration, and cooperation. They aren't here to hurt. They're here to help us in our evolution, okay? So remember that the first rung on this consciousness continuum must be stabilized before the higher rungs manifest, just as the mineral kingdom was stabilized before Earth could support the plant kingdom, okay? Here, sort of the use of linear thoughts is helpful, since such is how analytic mind generally perceives time and experience it. Now, although a case for nonlinear flow could certainly be made, it's likely that such would complicate this learning process for those who experience only in linearity. For those who are able to comprehend creation evolving beyond the limits of time and space, know that while these examples cannot categorically be said to be true, they can certainly provide us with models for the analytic mind to make the contemplative leap necessary for the growth in consciousness under consideration. So let's propose for a moment, or postulate for a moment, that ETs are likely the next level of consciousness to take embodiment at a physical earthly level. Now, such has already happened in other star systems, and the presence of Indra's diamond net affords the possibility for Earth to follow suit. If these ETs appeared in their natural bodies, very few people, if any, could see them. Now, although the level of consciousness they hold allows travel from star system to star system without spacecraft, the human form cannot afford the ease of such movement. Hence, the taking on of human form is done solely for the purpose of aiding humanity, and not to benefit the ETs in any way. From a linear perspective, you could say you are living at a point in time when you're just only beginning to tap one end of the spectrum of consciousness available for physical embodiment. Indeed, contemplative mind can readily grasp that the human condition is simply not as developed as it will become, and that the real basis for human beingness is not the material realm, but the realm of consciousness. So the third rung level on the time consciousness continuum has yet to manifest. Indeed, most humans cannot as yet even imagine such a state, and because this level of consciousness has not previously taken physical form on Earth, there simply are no collective memory banks to access to aid humans in understanding just what this state of awareness might be like. Just as the animal kingdom demonstrates the presence of a significant developing consciousness beyond that of the plant and mineral kingdoms, so this third level or rung on the time consciousness continuum will, at a much finer vibratory level, mirror that pattern. Of course, before such a level of consciousness manifests in physical embodiment, we must first discover what is possible in terms of the evolutionary development for the other two levels. So in other words, the presence of ETs in physical embodiment, continuing their own evolutionary process, will change the potential for humans. As humans learn to ground greater possibilities for the race, that stronger foundation will allow for greater potentialities to arise in the spiritual development for ETs. As these two levels support each other in expansion and growth, a greater potential will result from that, which is as yet unmanifest. And it will bring it from unmanifest to bringing it into manifestation. It's quite likely that the physical form that these greater beings take would not even be visible to the now existing human race. As greater awareness becomes available to those in human form, however, finer and finer vibratory levels will be experienced and appreciated. Humans, or those who have their eyes open, will eventually be able to see these ETs, not only in their grossest form, but in their higher vibratory form as well. This change in human perceptibility or perceptive ability, which has been opening to greater and greater numbers of people during the past 30 or 40 years, is actually a signal that the first rung or level is beginning to draw significant energy and awareness from the higher potential second level. Now, one of the things that's happening in this dawning of a new age, and it's the dawning of a golden age, and it's the dawning of the Aquarian age, is that the externalization of the hierarchy, the externalization of these more advanced beings, presents itself to us, and we get the opportunity to partake of it, which is quite a magic, special place to be in. We're at the dawning of a new age, and this energetic reimbursement, if you will, of our evolutionary process, the gods are coming to help us along, okay? Now, I want to talk about a second proposition, and it's talking about whether or not each thing is separate, okay? So now we're going to go back to the offerings of sort of traditional science for a moment. And the second proposition offered is the belief that each thing manifesting does so separate and apart from every other thing. Now, although analytic mind may hold to the notion that the self is separate from every other thing, from nature and from the cosmos, contemplative mind simply knows otherwise. Now, science used to think that everything was separate, and that has changed in the last little bit. However, contemplative mind actually knows otherwise. So without denying the appearance of separation, contemplative mind can realize that the notion of separation lies within the foundation of every kind of injustice that has arisen to afflict sentient beings the world over. Let me say that again in a different way. We know at a deep core that this idea of separation has been the energy and the gig behind, we're all different, we're all in it for ourselves, everybody who's different from you, you need to be afraid of and run away from. And this is the affliction of Mother Earth right now. Whether it's creating wars, pillaging and raping communities, as well as even Earth, or speaking cruel words in a moment of negligence, all this behavior arises from a belief in the notion that the self is separate from all others. Now, it's pointless, perhaps, to deny the appearance of separation, but it is enormously confining to assume separation is the only explanation for what is. Analytic mind may not understand a statement found in Rumi's love poems, if you will. Contemplative mind understands the intrinsic truth of his statement. True lovers do not suddenly meet one day, he says. They are in each other all along. The ego mind looks at another and wails, I cannot be him. He certainly cannot be me. We are so different. While such is how it appears, one must remember that the maturation of consciousness is not quite finished yet at this human level. And one must allow for the possibility that virtually all things are different in reality than the way they conventionally appear. Perhaps, in considering a plant, the ego mind screams, just look at it, I'm not like that, I don't have those funny little leaves, and I'm not green, and we're not the same. But as you investigate more deeply, you come to discover that you are the same thing. You and the plant are the manifestation of the life force that resides within you. And that life force is the same in both expressions. The forms are different, which necessitates different functions or functionality. The stuff of life, however, is the same in both you and the plant. Now, we live in a time when analytic mind is exploring what has been termed the third era in medicine. The first era was based strictly on allopathic medicine, which relies almost entirely on drugs and medical intervention for explaining the healing process. The second era of medicine was also called mind-body medicine and hinged on the huge discovery that if one's attitude is firm, it's harder for the body to remain infirm. It also afforded the experimentation with all manner of alternative methodologies for working with the body as a manifestation of the mind rather than something separate from the mind. The third era of medicine, this one that we are stepping into, and it's one that we are doing work with right now in the healing clinic that we have on Friday afternoons, holds that one's physical health or state can be affected by the thoughts, ideas, and or attitudes of others. In this third era, there has been scientific documentation, proof to analytic mind that such things as prayer, meditation, healing circles, and an open mind devoid of negative projection can positively affect one who is ill. Now, what this third era affords is an approach to medicine or healing wherein applied science acknowledges a connection in consciousness that suggests humans are indeed not at all separate from one another. This is a paradigm shift, and it is profound in its effect. Okay. Now, maybe this third era will lead to a fourth era wherein it's determined that consciousness is alive and can be understood as one. And perhaps it will be further determined that this one split itself into innumerable little pieces, imbuing each little piece with the potential to recognize itself when confronted by or with another little piece. Clearly, Receiving in terms such as these will unbelievably and undoubtedly stretch the confines of consciousness as experienced by the masses on the primary rung of the time-conscious continuum. Now, we're going to back up a bit. We're going to talk about the third proposition, which says physical reality is all that exists. Now, it was and is and sometimes is propagated that what you see is real and what you cannot see is not real, although that's changing. If you cannot measure it, test it, or in the laboratory probe it with the five senses, it doesn't exist. Now, with the rise of knowledge about quantum physics, however, this notion is beginning to fade. So quantum physics is the only branch of modern science that allows the state of don't know to be as creatively viable as known conditions and causes. So in the early 80s, some scientists in France demonstrated that two subatomic particles that have been connected, even if sequentially separated by vast distances, somehow remain connected. If a change is precipitated in one, the other changes as well. Now, analytic mind had no explanations for that, because since all particles are separate, or at least appear to be, they could have no effect upon one another. Now, contemplative mind, however, places way more meaning in connection than in separation, for it's able to grasp the difference in that which is and that which only appears to be. Indra, the web of Indra, having thrown out this magic net, touches 10 billion stars, okay, uniting them with the fibers of light. And these fibers, so fine that they cannot be seen by the human eye, nor with any human aids to the eye, connect all celestial bodies of the universe in such a way that any happening on any body is immediately transmitted through the fine living filament to all other bodies. In fact, in a single creative moment, an entire universe can be changed. Now, an interesting experiment that happened with Douglas Baker and George Delaware that happened years ago, but what they did is they took a lamb who had just given birth to her babies, her offspring, and they took one of the offspring 35 miles away from the mother, and they hooked the mother up to all kinds of electromagnetic field measurers. They tested her respiration and all of that stuff, and they slaughtered this little lamb. And at the moment that they slaughtered this lamb's offspring, the mother reacted quite violently and quite distressed. And they proved that there is sentience in the animal kingdom. They've also proved that there is sentience in the plant kingdom and also in the mineral kingdom. There is a connectedness. There is a connectivity that is undeniable. Now, in a single creative moment, an entire universe can be changed. So in truth, such is not so different from the intelligence contained in one's body. Like the diamond web, your fascia and your tissues literally touch every part of your internal body. It knows your stress patterns, as well as your organic weaknesses and strengths. Like your mind, your fascia constricts when influenced by karmic imprints, and it informs the entire body of these things. As the fact that you may be carrying one shoulder a bit higher than the other, you tilt your head off center a bit, or whatever. Those who work with bodies, as some of us do, know it can sometimes take years to release these holding patterns in a particular muscle, since it's not just the muscle that remembers, but literally the entire body, as informed by the fascia in your body. Now, you may believe a specific pattern of contraction is in the shoulder. The fascia in the buttocks remembers and reinforms the body by sending the message back up to the shoulder. So even within the realm of the purely physical, there are regions into which analytic mind can't penetrate. So, for example, consider the miracle of gestation, a little tiny ovum, no larger than the period at the end of any sentence, once fertilized, is encoded with all the information necessary to bring forth a human being imbued with the potentiality for great consciousness. How does that tiny cell know what to do? Even the most accomplished analytics cannot really explain the miracle or the mystery of this gestation. Analytic mind can count the cells or divide the term into periods, first trimester, second trimester, but it cannot touch this magic of gestation, since magic communicates only with contemplative mind. Let me say that again. Magic communicates only with contemplative mind. Now, gestation begins with a single cell. It starts dividing and replicating itself. Now, the tissues then begin to curve in on itself until it makes a sac. Now, the entire human body is formed from a collection of sacs and pouches and tubes. And one tube begets a brain stem. Another stretches itself into lung and begets an intestinal tract. One tube becomes the brain, which has a tube extending from it. You know, the tube fills with a specific type of cellular material and begats a nervous system. The nervous system is exquisitely sensitive and replicates the diamond net of Indra. For that little gestating organ of cognition contains the light centers, or diamonds that enfold this brain, encoding it with the potential for enlightenment. The law of correspondence. As above, so below. As below, so above. Now, there are many other mysteries that must be addressed, if indeed they are addressed, by contemplative mind. So think about it, right? How is it that a rose plant can produce leaves that always look and function alike, even though the soil and the climate conditions around the world may vary? From a reductionist point of view, the analytic point of view, when you isolate the biochemical agents in plant leaves, they're responsible for engineering leaf form and function. You'll discover that the ratio existing among those biochemical agents is very similar in rose leaves and in cauliflower leaves. However, these two leaves look nothing alike and function quite differently, emitting profoundly different fragrances, different forms. How is it that what appears to be striking biochemical similarities, rose leaves always look like rose leaves and cauliflower leaves always look like cauliflower leaves? Most people simply do not approach such mysteries, for to do so is to step out of the realm of the analytic mind and into the realm of contemplative mind. When we park our contemplative mind in a place that it can awaken to the miracle of life, you start to change the very fabric of your sense of reality. Now, you may have noticed that at times, when people are approaching death, they have a profound awakening to life. And there is an aspect of when you realize the profound message, the profound understanding, the profound awareness that life is such a mystery. How strange that as I approach death, I have learned now how to live. Isn't it odd? Isn't it odd? At this point in time when you are approaching death, contemplative mind gets cracked wide open. It's mysterious. Now, when Douglas Baker was in the war, he was in situations every day where he thought he would be killed. And in fact, he had his chest blown apart twice. So, you know, in that, they admit that they felt most alive when death appeared certain. The colors of nature change. They become so vivid in their moment-to-moment experiences that their sense could hardly bear the intensity. But the colors are not just pretty. They sort of come to life. They create a vibrant dance. Although most don't perceive it, there is motion to color. It's not static. Until a person awakens to that radical aliveness, that motion cannot be perceived by the senses. There's a saying that 99% of the world's population is asleep, and that 1% who are awake, however, live in a constant state of amazement. For now, contemplative mind is open, and the miracle of life is palpable. I'm going to tell you a Japanese Zen story, and it's a this Buddhist nun was out walking alone in the mountains, enjoying the beauty of the scenery. She wanders into an area where people didn't usually go, since there were wild animals. She was startled from her trance by a sound on the path before her. As she brought her attention into the conditions, she saw before her two tigers. In fright, she turned around and ran, and she ran for her very life. And glancing over her shoulder, noticed that the tigers were gaining on her. Such is the case. Heart pounding, she found herself on a precipice. And in her panic, she looked over and she noticed there was a little vine growing from the rocks hanging down the precipice. It appeared to be well anchored, so she jumped off, grabbing hold of it. And making a careful descent, she peered beneath her to see how far the drop to the lower ground was. Now, although the vine would allow her to go near enough to the ground that she could simply let go of it and fall down, she noticed that waiting at the bottom were two more tigers. To make matters worse, she drew her attention upward to where the vine emerged from the rock wall, and there were two gnats gnawing at the vine. Understanding her fate, instantly, she looked to one side. And there, growing in the face of the rock cliff, was a beautiful strawberry plant with one perfect strawberry hanging in the sunshine. And she reached out, just minutes from death, plucked the strawberry, placed it in her mouth, and savored the taste of the most wonderful strawberry in her life. Analytic mind would not be able to enjoy the strawberry. Contemplative mind, on the other hand, could be fully alive for the experience of the strawberry, even in light of the fact that these wild animals were about to eat her, I guess. We can be quite sure that the strawberry afforded her an experience of cosmic unity. Minutes from death, contemplative mind opened, and she took on a radical aliveness, becoming radically present for a total and direct experience. Now, analytic mind is rarely, if ever, open to direct experience. Analytic mind requires the experience of distance between the observer and what's being observed. Since analytic mind cannot surrender to the aliveness of an experience, or analysis would be lost, it can never merge with the experience. Contemplative mind, on the other hand, does not perceive itself separate from the experience it's having, but it cannot arise until analytic mind surrenders its whole in both the experience and the I who's having the experience. Let me give you another story about a Zen archer. Okay. The Westerner pitches up, looking to find out what it is about the Zen mind that participates in this. And since the mind state cannot be defined exactly, the Zen archer provided a demonstration. So he picked up his Zen bow, his arrows, and a blindfold. The master counted 60 paces from his target and took his position there. Now, as you may know, the Zen bow is not like a Western bow. It's very difficult to draw the string. And any untrained individuals just simply can't do it, no matter how great their strength is. To make his point, the master blindfolded himself and held the bow in such a way that made it even more difficult to draw. Thus compromised, the master raised the bow and let an arrow fly, hitting his target right in the very center of the bullseye. Now, to demonstrate to the analytic Westerner who was sitting there that first shot wasn't a fluke, the master then pulled another arrow, let it fly, and in typical fashion, he sliced the first arrow in two. Now, so in the West, shooting a bow is super analytic. One must place and do all of that stuff. Right? But to the Zen master, the exercise was all about the breath. With contemplative mind, the master can breathe in the universe and become one with it and all the forces that it contains. With concentrated focus, his mind can merge with the bow, with the arrow, and the target. But in order to accomplish that goal, he must first accomplish the complete release of the analytic mind so that the contemplative state of oneness with the universe may be made available to him. In that moment, is there a difference between the master and the bow? Now, the answer, of course, is completely beyond the reach of the analytic mind. Or as we are wont to say, it's beyond the intellect. So now we talk about moving beyond conventional science, beyond the tenets, beyond the restrictions of conventional science. So the diamond net of Indra supports and contains the knowing that allows mastery of such accomplished feats. From the perspective of such mastery, one can clearly see beyond the tenets of conventional science, that human development has reached its pinnacle, that each thing can be independently identified and is separate from all other such things, and that only those pieces and systems that can be perceived by the physical senses can be called real, hogwashed. When you look at that from the perspective of the Zen master, the cumbersome manipulation and distancing tactics of analytic mind offer little more than stumbling blocks to the direct experience of being. The diamond net, you see, communicates only with contemplative mind. Now, maybe, if your contemplative mind is now engaged, it may occur to you that you are, in fact, the vehicle through which those 10 billion, 10 trillion, 10 quadrillion stars shine. That delicate, sensitive diamond web is a web of consciousness, which simultaneously supports creation and operates upon and through creation, not only as you see it, but also in all of the infinite variations it has the potential to be. Contemplative mind transcends the boundaries of analytic mind, and it's the vehicle by which karma is transcended. The mind is liberated, and all notions of duality are dissolved. Now, that's some big and heavy stuff, differentiating the mind, isn't it? And we also talk, we want to extricate ourselves from these boxes that we get stuck in. And this is a modality to do it. And as we use and reiterate the three legs of the stool, study, meditation, and service, we participate in a dance that is the dance of awakening. I cannot express my appreciation of your attention. Thank you very much. I can also not express enough my joy at being able to be of service doing this work that we do at Retooling for our coming of age. It's Friday, May 13th, 2016. This is Jeff Dunphy. Thank you for allowing us to be of service. We look forward to speaking with you again soon.